Hello, hello everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Palace Way podcast. Something a bit different today. I'm Alex, as you know, and joining me is a guest we haven't had for some time. I'd like to reintroduce Tampa Palace, Florida's finest, back to the podcast. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Glad to be back on. Thanks for having me.
No, good stuff. Really glad to have you here. And just for those that are maybe new to the podcast or aren't familiar with both what you do on Twitter and what you do as a career, I mean, could you tell us a bit more about yourself?
So I don't do it anymore, but those may remember I did work in professional sports, specifically professional baseball, working with strength and conditioning and sports science. So working with return to play protocols, getting injured guys back, and also keeping our healthy guys durable and on the field, on the pitch, whatever you want to call it, keeping them healthy to continue playing.
It's a real shame there's not more vacancies at the club for people like you because it feels like we need them. It was quite interesting actually because we used to speak a lot about hamstrings when you came on the pod. I think we were in the middle of a horrendous injury crisis, as you remember, and you know some names familiar, some names not, but plenty of key Palace players were in the midst of that. And you know it was really interesting to have your thoughts on that. And more recently, of course, you're quite active on Twitter at Tampa Palace, just discussing all things to do with the club and looking at the data on how things have changed. We'll get onto some of those debates later, but I want to just explain for listeners a bit about the format of today's show because it is slightly different. We're kind of recording in two installments. So Mr. Tampa Palace himself and myself, we're doing the first part, we're looking at all things Forest, and then we'll be doing a second part with a different lineup looking at Bournemouth. I think there's just such a tight space between games, but we wanted to make sure we were fresh and that we were able to get you in on this. So really, really good to have you here and thank you for taking the time. So I'll kind of just give you a bit of the floor, really. I mean, I want to get your general thoughts on that game against Forest that we just had and a bit about going into the game and your expectations for that and, you know, how we played and some of the key moments for you. I mean, take it away. I'm really curious to hear what you made of it.
Yeah, I mean, expectation-wise, I wouldn't be upset at anybody for wanting all 3 points. I think, they're a lower side. We do need to try and take those points when we can get them, especially with the upcoming fixture list being as tough as it is. But that being said, all things considered, they are desperate for points as well. It is away from home for us at a tough ground. And we still have, it's our fourth match under this new manager. So there is a lot of growing pains that still need to be, ironed out, and things that need to be fixed. So all in all, a point isn't the worst thing that we could have. In terms of how we played, again, that thing that we just seem to be a little too passive when we take that lead. It happened at Luton. Tottenham was Tottenham. I'm not really going to put too much blame with that one. They're just a far, far superior side than we are right now. But same thing happened with Forest. We seem to just sit back a little too deep when we take that lead. And I know that Forest is a very pacey side. I know that they have the second most counterattacking goals in the Premier League this year. So the idea could have been that we didn't want to overexpose ourselves by playing too high of a line. I get that. I do think that we just over-exaggerated how deep of a line we needed to play, and it took the attacking impetus away from us a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was quite sluggish at times, very stop-start. But I think one person that really stood out was Daniel Munoz. I mean, what did you make of his overall game? I mean, he won man of the match as testament to his own ability. But I think there's so much more to unpack in terms of his ability to maraud that I think would really be worth discussing. So, what did you make of Daniel Munoz?
I absolutely love Daniel Munoz. I've loved him ever since we signed him. I mean, just made of steel, just runs through people. But that being said, he's clearly the more attacking wing back than that we have. Mitchell is a little more defensive, and Munoz was pinned back a little bit. Now, granted, part of that was because Forrest just overwhelmingly favored their left flank when they attacked. I think it was almost 50%, if not more. So he had to stay back a little bit in order to make sure that we're not giving up goals or giving up opportunities on that side. That being said, when we did get the ball, it just seemed that Munoz wasn't able to shine as much as he did. He stayed a lot further back than the Mitchell did, both in possession and overall. And he wasn't really allowed to shine. IU didn't have the greatest of games either. He kind of went missing for a lot of the match. So he didn't really have that kind of partner to play the 1-2s off of as much as he normally would. Overall, he still had a great game. Like you said, man of the match, he still did what he was supposed to do, but his touches were limited. Munoz, I'm saying, his touches were limited, his opportunities were limited, but he's still just a phenomenal player. He's a joy to watch.
going to be really interesting to see how Munoz interacts with Olise on the pitch. And I think we haven't really seen that flourishing down the right-hand flank with Ayew at the moment. It's kind of a consequence of injury, right? And Ayew himself has been brilliant for us at times this season. And, I'm not shunning him, but I think it will be really, really telling to see how he interacts with Olise when he comes back. Really excited for that. Definite threat. I mean, it was really, really clear. I think, as you said, there was a lot of individual pressure with him given how Forest play. But I want to just switch it over to the upper flank. Bit of a football pun there, so apologies. But Tyrick Mitchell, he was someone who came under a fair bit of criticism from some and yet a lot of praise from others. I think he's someone who gets a lot of spotlight put on him because of his, role as a young academy prospect that's come through the club and gradually solidified his place. But with no one to really pressure him for that left back spot, I think there's kind of an idea of complacency, I think, that some people seem to think. But let's look at the game itself. I mean, did you think he had a good game?
He had an interesting game. I'll put it that way. He was required to have a lot more of the ball, a lot more touches. He had just as many dribbles completed as Eze did. They both had two. I think that was the most in the squad for us for that day. But it's the same kind of thing that we saw, years ago under Vieira when we had that kind of hybrid four at the back that shifted into three at the back in possession, and Mitchell was kind of required to play that left back, left wing hybrid where he would push up to the left flank and play that wide role so Zaha could get into the half space and kind of do some damage. When we had that set up, Mitchell's attacking numbers weren't really where they should be for someone that was playing as a pseudo left winger for most of the match. And you kind of saw the same thing against Forest here. He got the ball a bit. He did keep width, which was so important and so vital. Just his presence staying wide really makes Eze much more dangerous because now Eze can jump into that half space and he can cut inside without everyone forcing him there because now there is still a threat on the other side for him to go wide too if he does need that outlet. But overall, his attacking play still, Mitchell just isn't where it should be. And that's not going to happen overnight either. I think we have to realize that. He was used to being this defensive fullback where his job was really defend the box and defend the for crosses and things like that under Hodgson. It's going to take a bit to change that. So there were signs. His dribbling ability was great. He was looking to take guys on, but that final ball needs to be a little bit better. And I think he needs to just be a little more confident when he gets close to the box as well.
No, definitely. I mean, even from the get-go against Everton in that kind of interim game where we shifted to a back five or a back three, depending on how you want to view it, he really made that wing back spot his own. And I don't think he's necessarily struggled or looked out of his depth. I just think, as you say, it's a question of refinement. It's a question of time. It's a question of, working on these individual aspects of his game. And as you say, I think confidence as well. We've seen the best of him in little flashes in his Palace career where he really can whip in a killer ball or in some cases go for it himself in a rare occasion. So I really want to see more of Tyrick Mitchell in that sense, in an attacking sense. And if there's anyone that can do that, it's Glasner. And on that note, I want to sort of tease out a wider debate here that we sort of discussed probably before the pod, really. A lot of people were saying that it felt like a Hodgson game in some aspects, or they're not really seeing, the big upturn in results against the so-called easier teams, or they're not seeing, a greater amount of final product from this team that, you would probably expect under a team that comes under Oliver Glasner. I mean, would you say that's fair? Because I know you've been doing a lot of looking at the data, and I'd like to just run through a bit of that and just get your own thoughts and analysis on how much things have changed under Hodgson and whether those claims are really true or not.
So again, we have a very small sample size, and statistically, it's probably not even fair to draw big conclusions yet. So that's my caveat. My take this with a grain of salt. That being said, we've seen a lot of good implications that we are improving as a side. I mean, going just to that game on Saturday, as I buries that ball that Wharton gives him right before halftime, and we're not talking about anything other than 3 points right now. I mean, we had the chances. The XG was there, signifying that we had the chances available to make those goals. We just weren't making them. So overall, though, across the board, you're seeing improvements. I did put a thread up on my account if anyone wants to go check it out and read along.
Give it a plug. Give it a plug.
Yeah, go ahead. It's CPFC underscore Tampa. Go ahead and check it out. It's just an analysis of the four matches of common opponents. So looking at Burnley, Tottenham, Luton and Forest under Hodgson versus those same four opponents under Glasner and seeing what differences there are. And really, we're seeing good improvements across pretty much everything. our goal, our points per match is going up, to, you know, slightly. Our XG, our MP, our XG allowed, so basically chances created versus chances conceded. Both of those are going in the right direction. What's important to me, one of the things that I really like to see is our progressive play. We're seeing a huge uptick of around 38% increase in touches in the opponent's box. We're seeing a big uptick in progressive carries, progressive passes, passes into the opponent's penalty area, and our shot creating actions are going up as well. So what does that all mean? Yeah, we're getting into the statistical mumbo jumbo. That basically means that we're putting the ball into dangerous areas on the pitch and giving ourselves better chances to score. Now, are we scoring as much as we should? The data says no. Now, what does that mean? That can mean one of two things. It means we're either just a bit unlucky and unclinical right now, or we're going against some hot goalkeepers. Probably a little bit of a combination of those two right now as to why we're not scoring, but the chances are significantly increasing. If we keep this up, we're going to see a higher, you know, uptick in points per match for sure. Now, the one thing that we need to get better at, and, you know, I've already alluded to it already to talking to you right now, is that defensive line of engagement, our aggression out of possession. It just isn't where it needs to be right now. Our tackles in the attacking third is down 60% in these four games, which is monumental, especially considering it was a Roy Hodgson side, which isn't exactly an aggressive counter-pressing team to begin with. And again, what are the reasons for that? We're taking early leads in really all four of these games. We've taken early leads. So I think that the mentality may be still in that little bit of Roy ball where we just want to see a 1-0 game out. We don't really want to score that second one and kill it off. And that mentality, you know, this isn't, we can look at the tactical analysis, the statistical analysis of this game, but there is such a huge mental component to it. And that mental component, those habits, they're not going to change overnight. So I think that's one big thing that's going on, is we just need to be a little more aggressive when we do have the lead. We need to not sit back as deep. And, you know, I'm a big Johan Cruyff guy. I love everything the guy did. And one of his best quotes was, the best way to defend a 1-0 lead is to, or 1-0 lead, I should say, is to score a second. So I think we need to look at that more often, and instead of just kind of being a little more complacent and passive when we do get up.
No, definitely. And thank you very much for that. I mean, your last point in particular reminds me of Glasner's overall philosophy, which is about scoring goals. I don't think he's someone, as much as he prizes discipline, I don't think he's someone who's ever going to tell this team not to try and score a goal or to try and defend that goal lead. I don't think it's by design that we're not scoring. I think it's combination of fitness, rustiness, adjusting to a new system. Maybe it's just a case of quality. And as you say, occasionally it's completely out of our hands and it's down to some good goalkeeping. I think Matt Searles yesterday, at the time of recording at least, really showed that, to be fair. He made some absolutely stupendous saves at time just to keep Palace out of it. And on another day, we would be talking about a very different result. I mean, I find it really telling from kind of your data standpoint that it feels like we've played these four games and we're looking at three winning performances out of that lot, even if we've just not managed to lose in some of those, right? It feels like there's a real shift there in terms of the underlying performance. It's just a case of now the results coming. I mean, would you go along with that?
100%. I think that for me personally, looking at the underlying stuff in this juncture of the season is more important than the results. Now, of course, we do need to get some results because we aren't out of the woods yet. You know, it's looking good for us. We would need a kind of catastrophic collapse to get right back down into that relegation battle. But we still do need to pick up some points. So I'm not saying that we can go losing or drawing every game we have left and it's going to be okay. But what I am saying is that the underlying data shows that if we continue on in this manner, we're going to get those points. We're going to nick 3 points where we don't deserve to earn, maybe not deserve, but where we aren't expected to. We're going to win some matches that, you know, we're going to show some fight and people are going to be a little surprised, because everything, and I'm talking everything, is going up. Our aerial win rate, which was such a big issue under Hodgson, has gone up considerably. We're getting the ball into the box more. We're getting more shots inside the box. We're taking more shots on target. We're taking more total shots. And all of this with keeping the same possession percentage. We actually have the exact same percentage numbers in these four matches under Hodgson and under Glasner, which is just a crazy coincidence, really. But the fact that we're limiting opponent's shots and shots on goal, and we're increasing our shots and shots on goal in the same amount of possession, shows that we're definitely doing something right. We're making it harder for teams to get chances and to get shots off, and we're more efficient in getting our shots off, moving quicker and more efficiently with the ball.
I mean, these are two huge things that have been lacking massively under Hodgson. So it's really encouraging to see it laid bare like that. I mean, if anything, rather than looking at it as if, why aren't these things already happening? Why isn't, the world turning upside down all in one go under Glasner? I'm kind of impressed that we managed to make this level of change in just 4 games in a training camp in just a small period. But, these feel quite systemic. And I think it's really encouraging that we're building on that. And I think it feels like your overall message here to fans is just relax. The change is positive. We've seen really encouraging signs. It's really frustrating that the results haven't come, but these are freak things. These are something that, is part of football, and it's something that we're used to in the wrong kind of sense, where it feels a bit more kind of inevitable given that Palace's underlying performances were poor. So I think there's a real kind of optimism that comes with that. Unfortunately, I do want to kind of touch on one key debate before I look at Mateta's goal to round up, because I think that'd be good to end on a high, right? But obviously, there's a lot of debate right now about Dean Henderson versus Sam Johnstone. And we really stuck up for Henderson on the last episode and discussed the kind of the outrage that seems to be surrounding Dean Henderson right now. But I mean, Sam Johnstone obviously unfortunately ruled out for the end of the season, as we know. I mean, what was your initial reaction? And then could you talk a bit about the differences between the two goalkeepers?
Well, first of all, to that point with the injuries, it's another reason why we need to be a little more optimistic for Glasner. I mean, depending on if you view Gyro as a left back or a center midfielder, we are one left back or one midfielder away from having a pretty decent starting 11 of injured players only. So the fact that we're doing this and we're seeing, uptick in form and the data showing some positivity with guys like Gehi out, with guys like Olise out, with guys like Edouard out, with obviously Doucouré not being around. That's super, super, super optimistic. We should be happy with that. Now, going to the goalkeepers, first I'll preface it by saying there isn't a debate anymore. Johnson's out. So we're going to have to get behind Henderson because he's the only one we got. I'll go to that goal on Saturday. I think it's ridiculous if anyone's going to try and blame him for that goal. I don't know too much about goalkeeping. I'm not a goalkeeping coach, but I do know that protecting front your front post is the most important thing, and that's exactly what he was doing. Wood the touch that Wood got on the ball with his head, where he was almost spinning and like looking away from the goal as he hit it, and just got this perfect angle. I mean, yes, he was on his wrong foot, but he's supposed to be on that side. He's supposed to be on that foot because he's protecting your post. So I think it was just a brilliant play for a striker to, knock that ball in. In terms of comparing the two, they're both above average to occasionally good to great keepers. I don't think either of them are bad. I don't think either of them are excellent. I don't think there's a ton between the two. I think that you just got to ride the hot hand, and we hope that Henderson can ride the hot hand and, have that as we see this season out. Henderson's probably a little bit better at distribution. And the numbers will back that up a little bit, where Johnson's probably a little bit better at coming out for crosses and being aggressive as a shot stopper. But all in all, the differences between the two are pretty negligible. They're not, supremely one, supremely low to the other. I think we're in good hands with Henderson. As long as we have a good defensive line in front of him, we're communicating, I think we're in good hands. I don't think that we're going from having to pull an academy kid out like we did last year. No offense to the boy, but that was a little bit of a dip in form and talent.
Yeah, I mean, Joe Whitworth did somewhat impress, particularly in the one that was a defeat to Brighton. I think he looked very comfortable, but I still think it was quite ridiculous that we were seeing shouts for, people to be recalled, which isn't possible, by the way, in this window. People to come out from the academy and just sort of take that place over Dean Henderson. I mean, there was a massive overreaction, I think, and again, the scrutiny won't help based on that key flashpoint where we conceded to Chris Wood. But as you say, I think it was quite literally out of his hands. Another thing I want to discuss really was Jean-Philippe Boutetta. It's a bit of a feel-good story that I promised at the end. I mean, obviously, he's once again scored under Oliver Glasner. Seems like a man very much in confidence right now. And I mean, just looking at the kind of wider context of the season, I mean, how impressed have you been with his output so far?
I think that we should be very optimistic with what's going on with him. I mean, I've criticized him when he's deserved criticism, and I'm going to give him praise when he deserves praise. He's been working his tail off, obviously, trying to get back into fitness. I think each start that he's had, he's looked a little bit less knackered by the end of it. He's still not quite there, the full 90. I think he still showed signs of fatigue the last 10 minutes or so of this match, but all in all, he seems like a different player under Glasner. And part of that goes to the gaffer. Part of that goes to our manager playing to his strengths. Yes, He's a big body, but he's not an out and out old school proper nine that you're going to head the ball into and he's going to hold up and just out jump out, you know, be stronger than people on things like that. He's not that type of player. He is a big body. He's decent at linking up play through hold up, but really his game is finding kind of open pockets of space for cutbacks. And that's exactly what happened on his goal on Saturday. First of all, we have to talk about the absolutely just sensational line breaking pass, the hockey assist. So we say from Jefferson Lerma to Eze to set that up. But, you know, Ebs sees that opening. He sees Mateta in a nice bit of space and he gives it to him for a beauty of a one touch shot. And he fired it in. I mean, that's how Mateta was at his best when he played in the Bundesliga, when he played for Mainz. That's how he is at his best. That's how we optimize his strengths, is by letting him kind of work and find those pockets for those cutbacks, letting him be somebody that we can be a focal point off, not just hoping that we can hoof the ball to him and create some magic, which I think was part of the reason he struggled so much under Hodgson and faced probably some unfair criticism in that regard. So I'm happy that he's doing great, but I will say that I'm not big on the him, it's black and white, him or Edouard debate. I think that one playing well is good. I think that both playing well is best, because it's going to bring out competition. It's going to bring out the best in both those guys. So as good as he's playing right now, we have to keep him starting. But as Edouard gets healthy and back to fitness, I really hope that those two continue to push each other in training and try to really feed off each other and get the best out of each other for that nine spot. Because I don't think that Edouard playing underneath is going to be serviceable at all. He's never really been like a number 10 type. He can float around a little bit and he can kind of be like a second striker, but he's not really the guy that's going to be getting the ball on the half turn and trying to create stuff for guys like we need out of those underneath 10 roles. I think that they're both competing for that single high nine spot, and I think that they're going to need to get the best out of each other in that regard. So if we can do that, I think that you're going to see the most results from our striker position. We're already seeing it with Mateta, so let's hope for some good fitness back from Edouard and some good competition between the two.
Well, there you go. That's the optimistic note we were looking for. Thank you very much for that. Just before we go, I mean, maybe we'll look pie-faced at even discussing this, but I mean, just going into the Bournemouth game before part two, what were your expectations, bearing in mind we're recording on the Monday between games? I mean, what sort of test do you expect Palace to face in that?
This is an important one for both sides, really. I mean, Bournemouth's pretty safe. I think they're, what, 7-8 points ahead of us. We're probably not going to catch them unless we go on a phenomenal run and they go on a pretty downward turn. But with Manchester City and Liverpool looming after this, I think this is a good chance for us to get some confidence and try and actually get all 3 points. You know, their Areola side, he was fantastic last year in La Liga with that kind of pseudo Bielsa style helter skelter pressing. They are going to be aggressive. They are going to press. And that might, hopefully, we need to see from Glasner is not sitting back and not just letting them press us and letting them keep the ball and dominate. I think we need to be a little more aggressive. I think we need to play a little bit of a higher line. I think we need to try and get the counter press working a little more than we've seen in these past few matches. Because if we just sit back and be passive with them, they're going to feast on us. They're gonna wait till our center backs have the ball, and they're gonna try and pounce on those and try and create havoc with turnovers and get shots on goal that way. So I'm hoping to see a little more aggression. I'm hoping to see a little more directness, and I'm hoping to see some more shots and trying to shift that field tilt into the opponent's final third a bit more and kind of live in there a little bit more.
Definitely. I mean, this could well age terribly, but I think it was really good just to set up kind of expectations for Bournemouth, just because I think it's going to be very, very interesting to see how two very intense pressing teams interact with each other. You know, I think the difference in shape is going to be really important, and particularly how we use the fullbacks. But really interested to see how this goes. And of course, in part two, you can join a renewed lineup. So listen, thank you very much for your time. Can I call you Patrick, or can I call you, what do I call you?
You can call me Tampa, you can call me Patrick, Pat, whatever you want, man.
I call you Patrick CPFC Tampa all in one? Anyway, we're rolling with it. Listen, thank you very much for your time. Can you give us another plug for your great stuff on Twitter?
Yeah, so it's at CPFC_Tampa, or just search Tampa Palace up in the search bar there. we try and keep optimism and positivity through looking at data and being objective in our debates. So one thing that I personally don't like is just kind of making baseless claims without having anything to back it up. So what I always try and do is look at how the data backs things up and see how things are going through that.
Yeah, good stuff. Thank you very much. And of course, thank you very much for your time as well.
All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate you having me on.
Hello, hello. Welcome back, which is something I don't say often on this pod. You know, it's not normally that we do this format. As promised, like for like sub, what feels like our own American international, Mr. Tampa Palace himself, has gone off. And on to complete the lineup in what is Palace's poshest podcast, I do apologise. Bruno, Mr. Bruno himself, how are you doing?
I was about to say, well, I do quite, you know, object to being referred to as posh. No, I wasn't going to put the accent on. Posh is maybe a bit harsh, but I'll tell you what certainly wasn't fancy. That was that performance against Bournemouth. It's absolutely diabolical.
Well, it was no Peterborough, I'll put it that way. Whee! Sorry, had to get that in. Yeah, I mean, it was a very interesting one. Obviously, as listeners will have heard in part one, we were discussing the idea of, you know, very much things staying as they are and, you know, the need for Glasner to kind of keep the faith with his own system, which I'm sure he does, but just to kind of push forward because we're seeing, at least in the kind of back end in the data world, if you like, that things are working and things have markedly improved under Hodgson in a kind of shutdown of the criticism that we've seen lately. I mean, I'll talk about expectations going into this game in a bit, but just going along with that statement about the need to kind of keep faith in the changes that we've already brought in. I mean, do you go along with that? And how did you find it working against Bournemouth?
Well, the way I'm kind of taking these Glasner games is by stacking them against how we played against the same opposition under Hodgson and sort of seeing how we develop across the Glasner games as well from start to where we are now. What I realized with Bournemouth is, yes, we lost the game, but there was an overall improvement in our cohesion and fluidity in the three-back system. I felt like Munoz and Tyrone Mitchell especially are becoming more comfortable in their roles out wide. And I felt like Mateta did an especially good job as that target forward, which is such an important role in the Glasner system. And at the end of the day, I think we put in a much better performance against the same Bournemouth side that embarrassed us at home at Selhurst. We halved the final scoreline. So there's an improvement there. Obviously, it was a grim showing and we were hurt by injuries, you know, whether it's Eze not being up to full fitness or the fact that we had to play two midfielders at centre-back in Ozo and Lerma. The former obviously made the error that led to the winning goal, but you can't blame an 18-year-old for being played out of position. You just can't. You know, we are in an injury crisis and that's what's, I think, creating an illusion of a lack of progression when in reality we're coming across a lot faster and a lot more effectively than I think most people will realise.
I mean, controversially, I'd argue that even under Hodgson, things would have been mildly better if, you know, our players weren't injured. I think that's probably a given.
Absolutely.
Really. It's probably absolutely a bit of a no-brainer, but, you know, obviously we know that Hodgson was part of the reason for the exacerbation of that crisis through underworking the players and presumably ignoring some advice or, you know, communication between different aspects just wasn't going well. So, I mean, it's a real shame, but I think, you know, to come away even despite this absolutely turgid run of injuries with a fairly cohesive style and with obvious progression in very little time is encouraging. We spoke a bit on the last pod about Marbella, and I wanted to come back to this point about David Ozo because it was referenced that both in the training camp and against Millwall in these friendlies, Ozo played at centre-half. You know, he came on in that capacity. It's not something that he's really been trained to do for a long time. It's never something we saw under Hodgson. It's not really what we saw at academy level as well. So obviously there's going to be some teething pains there, but it is, you know, there is something to be said for the experience he's had in that position. It wouldn't have been totally alien for him.
See, I'm going to have to disagree with you there because you can talk about teething pains, but you'd expect teething pains for a you know, 18-year-old making the step up to the Premier League. You know, he's already having to deal with those teething pains, and it feels like we've thrown in like a million abscesses in the way by throwing him at centre back. You know, if we're going to continue the dental analogy for some reason, but
that's a crazy analogy.
I just feel like, you know, it's a player that's already going to struggle because he's not quite ready for the Premier League yet. He's still incredibly young. You know, he is physical and strong for a player so young, but you saw how he got bullied by Semenyo, and that's just what happens when you put a player in a position where they're not used to covering certain distances. And yeah, at the end of the day, they are professional footballers, but he's a much more recent professional footballer and a much younger one. And therefore, you've got to cut him some slack because playing, 50% pace games in friendlies against, lower opposition for 45 minutes at centre back is so different to being subbed on, with 20 minutes to go at nil-nil in a Premier League game against a better opposition team, because that's what their squad is. It's probably better than ours at the moment. It's a decision that was forced by a necessity to chase the win, and I respect Glasner actually going for that, because I think the reason he's made that decision, as baffling as it may be, is for, forward-thinking aims, whilst I feel like Hodgson would stick to the draw. Obviously, we came away with 0 points instead of one, but, I'm willing to view that tactical attempt and its outcome as negative byproducts of a hopeful decision, that shows a change in mentality. I know that's a little bit of waffle to try and justify it, but at a certain point, you've got to start thinking and acknowledging about how screwed we are, in terms of injuries. And I just don't think we can blame David Ozo that much for the outcome of one mistake at this level with his experience and his attributes.
I know too. I think it's, if anything, the criticism has to be leveled at Glasner. But I'm just saying that there's a rationale there. I don't necessarily disagree with what you're saying there. He still hasn't had enough minutes recently, let alone at all in the Premier League to, be a confident Premier League player. And I think at such a young and delicate age, he's already achieved so much. And if anything, I think he should just come away from that game with his head held high. He didn't disgrace himself. He made a very honest mistake. I think he gets caught in two minds there when somebody comes for him. Yes, he gets, bullied or whatever, which I think is a bit harsh, but he goes to plant his foot and try and really cement himself and then just let Semenyo kind of slip away and kind of shoulder barge him a bit and manages to break free. So he's kind of caught in two minds. Does he go with this man? Does he kind of try and hold him off? And I think in the end, he gets the kind of the worst of both worlds. But again, as you say, I think that has to come down to experience. It's really not something that we should be digging him out for. I think it's just a sad, sad symptom of the crisis we went through. I mean, just to put it in perspective, we don't even need to remind fans that the likes of Elise Decore and Gueye are out. But when you look at the subs we brought on, we're looking at the likes of a very inexperienced, Premier League academy prospects out of sheer necessity, whereas they can bring on the likes of Clivert, Semenyo, Kerkez, and so on. I mean, even for a club of Bournemouth stature, I think they've themselves had an excellent summer of recruitment. And I think they were teething pains for themselves as well, as we saw early in the season, but they've kind of matured into the league and they've grown themselves. We just have to kind of keep the faith and hope that, whether it's kind of the new signings that have already gelled brilliantly and come in very fast and made a huge impact, or whether it's kind of our youth products coming through, those that are finding their feet in this Palace side and that are finding these feet in the new Glasner system just need to kind of stick with the process. The data shows that we've transformed our style of play, that we are more creative. I just think we're not seeing the fruits of the labor of that labor. I wanted to draw attention a little bit to Glasner's start at Frankfurt, because it was a really interesting thing that did the rounds on Twitter. I think it took him about 7 or 8 games to get his first win, coincidentally against Bayern Munich as Frankfurt manager. Plenty of draws in there too. It wasn't like a sort of horrendous losing run, but I think again, there's a kind of timely reminder, as ironically there was with Bournemouth at the start of their season, that these things take time, as the Swift song goes, right? And it's really, really encouraging to see some of that back end stuff going well. We just need to stick it out. That's essentially, again, a very rambly way of getting to that point. But I think it was really interesting to see Glasner out shout. I mean, I did it as a joke and then sort of went, oh, fuck, April Fool's yesterday. But it was really, really funny to see some of those frustrations coming out. And I think even those that did, I think they know it's a bit tongue in cheek. So yeah, I'm really excited for the future under Glasner still. And I think this recent run has just put a bit of a dampener on things. I will take a breather, Bruno. The fixture list coming up is particularly grueling. So looking at those games ahead, I mean, how many points do you really see us getting, and where should we be eyeing up those opportunities? Because ironically, I think United at home is one, but I'll let you have a think on that.
I'm weirdly optimistic, mostly because of Glasner's record at other teams, where he tends to attack stronger teams. We haven't really seen him play a stronger team with a better lineup yet. We know Michael Olise will be back this weekend, on the bench at least. There are other players nearing a return, such as Mark Gahey, Jezrin Rucksacki, and even Cheick Doucouré as we approach the end of the season. So, I mean, it's tough to think about, but I can see us picking up minimum 6 points for the rest of the season. And people will be saying, where are we getting this from? I can see a Fulham slip up. I can see a West Ham slip up. I can see a point at home to City this weekend. It's unlikely, but if he got his first win against Bayern Munich after a bad run, why can't we get one against City at home at Selhurst? I reckon we will actually get behind the lads. It's been nearly a month since the last game at Selhurst, and everyone's just ready for something exciting to happen. There'll be an atmosphere if we show, any kind of attacking intent. It'll really spur on the fans and by extension the players. Newcastle are a bit 50-50. Yet again, that's a late night game at Selhurst, which can always play in our favour. United at home, like you mentioned, even Wolves away is winnable. Final day against Aston Villa. If we need the points and Aston Villa don't, then that could obviously be a chance where they rotate and we could scrape something. So, I think any shouts about us getting, 0 points or 1 point for the rest of the season are somewhat fantasy, or rather nightmare. I can't see a situation where we walk away with less than 4 points at the end of this run. And that would put us on to 34 points, which would mean Luton would need, more than 12 points to send us down, basically, because I can't see Burnley or Sheffield overtaking them. And for them to get 12 points in the next seven would be uncharacteristic, considering they play, City, West Ham away, Wolves away, good teams like Bournemouth as well. So, they could maybe get six or eight or even nine, but I can't see them getting, enough to rival us with a couple more points in us. It's an atrocious season, no doubt. And I'm sorry to kind of move away from the initial prediction, but at the end of the day, I'm taking survival at this point. It's about next season.
Well, exactly. God, it's
I
just to
think
cut you
that's.
off. Sorry, I was just going to say it's been a, such a grueling slog, isn't it? I mean, I'm looking at the table thinking, God, we've got 8 games. I'm thinking, God, just shoot me. Really? Like, you just can't be bothered to put yourself through it at this point.
Well,
Ironically, I'm. It's, yeah, go on.
I was just going to say, it's just on the plan for the season. It's just this whole season has been about next season. It's all been about preparing for next season and the rebuild next season at this point in the summer. So it's a real test of everybody's patience. I think the players are probably struggling with it, especially if they're not going to be here, right? It just feels standing still isn't ever a good thing in sport, and we've willfully done it, and it hasn't been enjoyable in any way. It hasn't been a fun season with Eze and Elise and Hodgson Ball as, the powers that be thought it could be. So, it's been grueling. It sucked. Let's get behind the players and, hope we can at least confirm our safety with some excitement and flair and hopefully no more injuries.
Oh God, let's hope. Like the thing is with Glasner, like I think say what you want about him, I think this is a complete free hit of the rest of the season, and that's to be cherished, not to be, slandered or shut down. It's like this is a hugely important period where the threat of relegation is increasingly minor. He has a, such a clear run to work with the players to implement his tactics in games and to actually blood the squad he's got, as well as having a strategic eye on the summer with a full pre-season. And I think all of that could be incredibly valuable as one kind of giant package of preparation. So I'm really excited to see what happens there. Yeah, sorry to cut you off. I was going to say it's my birthday on Saturday, the big 2-4, which sounds like a very Mark Horrigan thing to say. But oh well. If there's one thing that will ruin my birthday, it's probably Palace, which again feels like Bidham's the Palace way. So very much looking forward-ish to that, but I'll probably eat my words at full time. There's a bit of an elephant in the room because I realised we forgot to talk about something, and I think rather than make it a bit of a VAR downer, I actually was talking, obviously, with Tampa in our previous apart about the resurgence, or should I say, the continuation of strong form from Jean-Philippe Mateta, and it was such a shame to see him ruled out for that offside. But I mean, he's a man on confidence, and all right, he had that moment against Bournemouth, but I mean, he really played such a huge role in Eze's goal, and then it was just so crippling to see it ruled out for such a minor reason, basically for having clown feet, which feels like an absolutely horrendous thing to be ruled out for. But rules are rules. I mean, what was your take on the overall incident, and what were your thoughts on Mateta's general form? And you can go back to Forest if you want. And ultimately, did you think the Eze tap-in should have stood?
I think Mateta has been great for us, especially since the Manchester City game. the 2-2. I think he's probably the only reason the season hasn't left all of us wanting to kill ourselves, because the sheer enjoyment that we all get out of watching him fumble and bumble around a football pitch and somehow end up putting it in the back of a net with panache is the one true highlight of this season, if the moments for the rare glimpses of Elise aren't enough. I think he played well on Tuesday. He played well on Saturday. He holds up the ball well. And sometimes when you're sort of slow to accelerate and a target man, you're always going to be in those sorts of positions where you could be deemed offside. It's the right decision to rule it out, as much as that pains me to say. We ask for consistency, and at the end of the day, if you're offside by any margin, the goal will be ruled out. And in this case, it was. And if you're in an offside position and the goal's ruled out, I've got no problem with that. Obviously, there's debate within the law and amongst fans about whether or not, decisions that tight should be, favored towards the attacker, whether there should be some kind of leeway. But this season, the rule has been, if you're offside, you're offside. Without wanting to sound sort of Brexit is Brexit, like, it was done to the letter of the law. The lines were a bit wonky, a bit ridiculous that they couldn't sort that out. But at the end of the day, sorry, he just is offside. Like, there's not much to add to it. Obviously, it would have been great to see Eze's goal count and for JP to be involved in another great goal. But he just wasn't in the right position, sadly for us and sadly for him.
Yeah, of course. I mean, the goal burden's really fallen to Matata and Eze, and I think particularly for the latter, the creative burden's been so much on Eze, and it's been a real shame to see people piling onto him as well. So just briefly before we close, I mean, what do you think of fan criticism again of Eze? Are we kind of in a cycle whereby he comes back from injury, has a terrible few games, everyone says he's off it, past it, then he scores a few, and everyone says, wow, he's a 60 million player, and then he gets injured again right when he's at his peak, and then the cycle continues. I mean, is that kind of the way for Eze? Do you think the criticism's fair? Do you think there's a lot more to it than that?
Whoever posted that little cycle on Twitter is spot on, to be honest, because Eze is one of the three most technically gifted players at this football club, and he's been great for us. He may be leaving in the summer, but it kind of hurts me to think about how much value we've lost off our assets due to injuries this season. I reckon Doucouré's shaved off 30 mil with the injury, Elise probably 20, Eze probably 20, but who knows, right? Because his name kind of just has that excitement, and people have seen him bounce back so many times, as I'm sure he will do again. He will probably put in an excellent performance against City, who of course are a side that's interested in him. So I'll be watching out for him on Saturday, because in a game where we will be defending presumably for the majority of it, someone who has magic in him and in his boots will be the player that changes the game for us. And that's Eze. So hopefully we'll move on to the next phase of the cycle now that he's had a couple of games back from injury. And if he gets a couple of minutes with Elise on the pitch at the same time, it'll provide results similar to when he came back against City, where of course we managed a 2-2 draw later on, thanks to an Elise penalty and an Eze pass in the build up to that. So the criticism is obviously unwarranted for a player that's done so much for us. And it's just the product of an unbelievably grim season of football, defined by poor injuries, poor decision making, and general bad luck.
Well, speaking of getting it done with the season, I mean, that's how I'm feeling, right? We're gonna have to wrap up this pod as well, unfortunately. But Bruno, thank you very much for your time, just for briefly coming on. Really, really good to hear your thoughts there. I think if there's anything to take away from that, I'm just feeling optimistic again. Some of our players are coming back. I think, we've got a free hit for the end of the season. I'm not expecting any results. Maybe I'm a bit more downturn than you on that. I think realistically, yeah, maybe we'll get a win somewhere, maybe we'll get a few draws. I'm not expecting it to be pretty or the most exciting period that we've ever seen as Palace fans. But it's football in the sunshine, it's good away days, chances are we're not going down. It's just, we'll put it out in the summer. I think there's a real chance to reset here, both from a literal PSR cycle perspective, from the fatigue of the players, from the coaching staff's fresh chance to work with the team. I think it's really, really interesting, and I think that good times are around the corner. I think we're not really going to see Oliver Glasner hit his prime until we get there. So again, keep the faith. I know it's a massive football cliche, but I think right now, when the fan base is just so fed up, dragged through the mud, so kind of disunited, I think there's never been a better time to really rally around the future and get excited that there is some kind of a longer term or more progressively thinking plan that's been put in place. So, Bruno, thank you again for your time. Any closing thoughts for our listeners?
Nope, just wanted to say thank you for having me on.
No worries. Didn't even wish me a happy birthday in advance, twat. And on that annoying bombshell, very sorry, Bruno, I'm joking, don't cry. Thank you very much for listening, everyone. If you could leave us a review, you can say whatever you want. 1 star, 5 star, please just be honest. We want all feedback possible. Like, it's really important to us. We go through everything, and we want to obviously try and make the pod as slick as we can. It's all really appreciated. We're increasingly speaking to people on Twitter that reach out to us to sort of give feedback, and again, for better or worse, in some cases, we're really delighted by that, and we've really tried to onboard some of those into our production. So thank you very much for your time, and thank you for listening. More importantly, enjoy the weekend. If you're going to Selhurst, please try and enjoy it. I think there's a lot of reasons to be negative around the club at the moment, but despite that, I think I've outlined a kind of positive case here. It's City at home. Just try and make the most of it. We're nearly there as a fan base, and I think that's something to keep in mind. I think we're all in this kind of weird and wonderful roller coaster that is Crystal Palace together, and just enjoy the bumps. It's part of the journey. It's part of football. You should know that as much as I do. But once again, thank you very much for listening. Stay safe, and we'll see you in the next one. Up the Palace.